Hi, everybody. We need your help if you like this podcast. Make sure you subscribe if you're not already getting us every day. And tell your friends. Plus, leave us a rating and review on iTunes. It really helps us in a big way, and it helps other people find us.
We're in an extremely serious and unprecedented situation.
It is clear that this House faces a much more fundamental question. Does this House want to deliver Brexit?
For Prime Minister Theresa May, Monday was a very bad day.
I've listened very carefully to what has been said in this chamber and out of it.
It's been over 2 years since Brexit, when voters in the United Kingdom decided in a referendum to leave the European Union. But with a March 2019 deadline fast approaching, officials have yet to iron out just what the UK's relationship with the economic bloc will look like.
From listening to those views, it is clear that while there is broad support for many of the key aspects of the deal, on one issue, the Northern Ireland backstop, there remains widespread and deep concern. As a result, if we went ahead and held the vote tomorrow, the deal would be rejected by a significant margin.
Time is running out. And for those who thought a deal negotiated by May with the remaining 27 EU nations might bring some order, well, that all fell apart on Monday.
We will therefore defer the vote scheduled for tomorrow and not proceed to divide the House at this time.
A postponement of the vote, it didn't go over well.
The government has lost control of events and is in complete disarray. Yep.
That's Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn speaking at Monday's hearing at the House of Commons. We'll look at the long and winding road right now on The Takeaway. Here to help us make sense of the chaos is Gillian Tett, the U.S. Managing Editor for the Financial Times. Gillian, welcome to The Takeaway.
Great to be on the show.
And if you thought that as an American that Brexit would not affect you, think again. Andrew Marshall is Vice President of Communications at the Atlantic Council and a former foreign editor of The Independent. Andrew, thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you.
So, Gillian, let's start with you. This was a very dramatic postponement of the vote. How did this deal come about?
This was indeed a very dramatic postponement, and frankly, postponing was not something which most people thought would happen. It's deeply embarrassing, deeply humiliating for the government, and has tossed the UK into even more uncertainty after, frankly, almost 3 years' worth of deep uncertainty. It came about because Theresa May realised that she simply could not have enough votes in Parliament to pass the deal she'd cut with the rest of the EU. Rather than submit herself to an embarrassing defeat, which would almost certainly force the vote of no confidence and pushed her out, she's basically taking a very bold gamble and going to the rest of the European Union pretty much on her knees, begging them to do something, anything, to help her actually get this deal through Parliament.
I want to play a little bit more of Prime Minister May yesterday. This is a clip that we think seems to really illustrate the core of the impasse here.
If you want to remain part of the single market and the customs union, be open that this would require free movement, rule-taking across the economy, and ongoing financial contributions, none of which are, in my view, compatible with the result of the referendum. If you want to leave without a deal, be upfront that in the short term this would cause significant economic damage to parts of our country who can least afford to bear the burden.
Gillian, tell us a little bit about those two competing narratives that May is trying to reconcile there.
Well, she is absolutely correct, because when the Brexit votes happened, there was a perception by the Brexiteers that the UK could essentially leave the rest of the European Union without causing a great deal of damage, and that it would probably be able to maintain trading relations with the rest of the bloc, but not have to subject itself to the European Union's rules or make contribution to the European Union's central kitty. What has become clear in the last couple of years are two things. Firstly, that the European Union really operates with four interrelated pillars: free movement of capital, people, goods and services. And essentially, it won't take any one of those four elements out of the rest of the pot and just let the UK, say, enjoy free trade without having free movement of people. But the other huge problem that almost nobody foresaw when the Brexit vote happened is Northern Ireland. Because if Northern Ireland is inside the UK, which has a complete break from the rest of the European Union, you have to put a new border between North and South Ireland. And that jeopardises the peace process and all manner of economic ties. But if Northern Ireland remains inside the rest of the European Union, you have to put a border between Northern Ireland and the rest of the UK and essentially break the UK up. And it's a completely intractable problem which nobody has solved yet.
Gillian, what's been the EU's reaction to the collapse?
Well, essentially what Jean-Claude Juncker, told Theresa May this morning, and he's head of the European Commission, is that there won't be any renegotiation of the deal, that the deal on the table is the only deal on the table. And it's difficult to overstate the degree to which the rest of the European Union is absolutely fed up with this. You have tremendous amounts of distraction in France and Germany and elsewhere right now. Macron, the president of France, is dealing with his own internal crisis, and he's in no mood to give concessions and doesn't have the attention span to do that. In Germany, Angela Merkel is stepping down in the future, and again, there's a great concern about where German politics is heading. Italy's got its own endless, never-ending financial crisis and tensions. So nobody on the European Union side is willing to sit down and go through time-consuming, difficult negotiations. They may give Theresa May a bit more language. They may give her a few concessions here or there. They may play along with her and hope the sheer effect of waiting forces the British politicians to recognise that there's no better deal on the table and they have to vote for this. But it's not going to be an easy resolution on any side whatsoever.
You know, one of the interesting things is that the what next question here is one that even the New York Times had to essentially draw a map to explain what all the possibilities are that could happen after this this failure. What happens next? In your opinion, what is the most likely scenario for May and for Brexit going forward?
Right now, there is an incredibly wide range of possibilities of what could happen next. The possibility of the UK never leaving has definitely risen because the people who want a second referendum are basically rallying the troops and getting ready to push for that very hard. The problem is that the Labour leader, Jeremy Corbyn, has not yet indicated whether or not he would support that. It's also entirely possible that Theresa May does manage to eventually force this deal through Parliament, partly because the act of waiting long enough will force politicians to realise how unpleasant many of the other alternatives are. But the other risk, which really spooks the financial markets, is, as Theresa May said, a crashing out without any deal at all, which would essentially mean a very significant rupture and shock to the British economy and the rest of the European Union, not to mention the wider global economy, next spring.
Gillian Tett with the Financial Times, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Andrew Marshall at the Atlantic Council, we want to bring you into the conversation now. Things fell apart yesterday pretty dramatically on the floor of the House of Commons, Andrew, but that really wasn't a surprise that the vote wasn't going to pass. Why did May take it this far?
Well, I think as Gillian pointed out, it's pretty clear that Brexit is broken. Prime Minister May has taken this deal probably as far as she can take it. She's now looking for changes to that. She knows that changes are not going to be easy to get from her European counterparts. But she also knows that her own party, the Conservative Party, is deeply divided over this. She knows that the Labour Party on the other side of the House of Commons is relishing every moment of her discomfort. It's not very clear she had too many other options. And now it's very, very unclear where things go. And in my opinion, that's bad for Britain. It's also bad for the United States when a country like the UK, with which the US has such strong ties, is in such an uncertain and risky position.
Let's talk a little bit about that relationship and the potential influence over the UK vote here. President Trump surprised many people in the UK when he came out against the Brexit deal. Do you think Trump contributed to the vote's ultimate failure?
I think it's unlikely it had much direct impact, but it's certainly true that people on the Eurosceptic wing of Theresa May's Conservative Party are eager and keen to begin discussions with the US on a free trade deal, which they think can be a significant boost for the UK economy. Whether or not that's true, it's certainly the case that relations with the US are going to be absolutely critical for the UK as it deals with this this issue of realigning itself with the European Union. Unfortunately, I think in another time under another president, we might have seen more diplomatic activity around Brexit. We might have seen more effort to have some useful conversations. There's been very little of that. Washington is very consumed with its own psychodramas at the moment.
I want to bring in another conversation point here that this is not just about political stability. There's also this really important issue about economic stability. We saw U.S. markets yesterday reacting to the Brexit decision. Could there be economic ramifications here in the U.S.?
Yes, the trade between the UK and the US is significant. The UK is one of the US's top five export markets. But I think the really important connections there are, firstly, the two countries are very big investors in each other. They're the largest investors in each other's markets, with something like a million jobs in both countries, depending upon investment from the other. And the connections in particular between the financial services sectors are incredibly tight. London and New York really are the nylon cities. They trade together, they work together. They are almost two halves of the same person. And dislocations to that, which the financial services industry has been trying to deal with as we get closer and closer to what's a very uncertain deal, would have an impact, I think, on both sides of the Atlantic.
Andrew, what's been the EU reaction generally? I mean, I know it's hard to take that entire landmass and give one sense of it, but are people in favor generally, or is there a sense that, they can take it or leave it?
You'd find many, many different strands of opinion in Europe about the UK's departure. There are those that would say, well, you were never on board for this in the first place. It's time to go and good riddance. There are others that would say, well, we actually shared some of your questions, some of your doubts. We'd love to have you stay in. Why can't you remain within the European Union, making your points inside the club rather than outside? There is, I think, the predominant sense is one of bewilderment, that here is this country that has a reputation for stability, for a stable, well-established political culture, for making reasonably good political decisions at many critical points over the years. And apparently it's thrown all of that out the window.
Andrew Marshall is Vice President of Communications at the Atlantic Council. Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you.
How does a teenage trafficking victim end up facing more than five decades behind bars? That's the story of Cyntoia Brown, whose 51-year sentence reignited the debate over the treatment of young women of color in our criminal justice system. Brown was just 16 when she shot and killed a 43-year-old man who solicited her for sex. She was tried as an adult in Tennessee, convicted of murder, and sentenced to life behind bars in 2006. Her legal team challenged that sentence as unconstitutional, pointing to a 2012 Supreme Court ruling that protects most juveniles from life sentences without parole. But last week, a Tennessee Supreme Court ruled that Brown won't be eligible for release until she served 51 years. I spoke about Brown's case with Marsha Levick, the chief legal officer at Juvenile Law Center, and Jeree Thomas, the policy director with the Campaign for Youth Justice.
It is deeply upsetting that it wasn't recognized that she was a teenager. She was underage and being solicited for sex. My organization, along with a number of organizations, truly believe there's no such thing as a teenage prostitute. This is a young girl who should not have been solicited in this way. I do believe that she felt it was self-defense. If you listen to her describing the situation, she was in fear for her life. She believed that the man had, well, she knew that he had many guns, that he was a sharp shooter in the military, and she believed that he was going to harm her that night. But unfortunately, that belief wasn't really taken into consideration, I feel, to the extent that it should have been.
Marcia, I want to bring you in here. If you could give us a sense of the Supreme Court decision that could provide a backdrop here and how Brown's legal team has been using that to argue for her release unsuccessfully.
Sure. The United States Supreme Court, in a series of decisions that began in 2005 and then continued through 2016, essentially addressed sentencing for children who are being prosecuted and sentenced in the adult criminal justice system. And relying on our Eighth Amendment's ban on cruel and unusual punishment, the Supreme Court not only banned the death penalty, but also banned life without parole sentences for children convicted of homicide, in particular, mandatory life sentences. And what has happened in the wake of those decisions is that we have seen a kind of, I think, toying with the decision's mandate in the sense that while courts are not, in fact, imposing life without parole sentences on many children across the country convicted of homicide, they are imposing virtual life sentences on those individuals. And by that, of course, it's exactly what we see in Santoya's case. To impose a 50-year sentence on someone, a 40-year sentence, or even higher, 60, 70-year sentences on young people as they go into prison, we are dooming them, if not necessarily to die in prison, we are creating a scenario where they will likely come out of prison on a stretcher, or they will come out of prison with very little quality life experience left for them.
I also want to bring up the issue that I think is quite obvious in this conversation, which is race and gender. Santoya was a 16-year-old woman of color, and we know from federal data that women, girls of color, are disciplined more harshly in school, for example. I'm wondering if either of you could give me a sense of how race plays into her case specifically. And the reason why I'm asking this is because I think about more recent rape cases, for example, Jeffrey Epstein. I think about Brock Turner. I think about Jacob Anderson. These are all white men who, while are not being convicted of murder, their sentencing for, you know, sex crimes has been quite light to nil. So how does race play into this?
It's impossible to have any conversation about our justice system in this country without confronting race and racism. And the system is largely populated by men and women, young women and young men of color, whether they are black or brown. And that legacy, the legacy of racism, slavery, white supremacy in this country has created a system that has, I think, frankly, become untenable in a constitutional democracy to tolerate the degree to which we have ravaged, I think, communities of color in this country. Her situation is compounded by her gender in the sense that I think the justice system has always been paternalistic, in the sense that we are frankly less tolerant of behavior that girls and women engage in because we imagine that they should be better than that, which is a kind of twisted analysis that results often in less tolerance and greater punishment for conduct that they engage in.
Jeree, any thoughts on that, the racial disparities?
Yes. So I would add, again, when you mentioned that, you know, historically there has been this issue of black youth and brown youth being disproportionately impacted by the system, that's absolutely what we see in the data. So in 2016, black youth were about 14% of the population, but 51.9% of the youth who were transferred by juvenile court judges in our country. And so we see the disproportionality in the number of young people being transferred to the adult system. We also see it in the types of sentences that the young people receive. So according to the Campaign for the Fair Sentencing of Youth, they have a new report in which they find that 72% of the children sentenced to life without parole sentences since the Miller decision by the Supreme Court have been black children. So Marcia was absolutely correct. There isn't really a way to disentangle the issue of black and brown children being disproportionately negatively impacted by the adult criminal justice system.
Marcia, does Santoya have any legal recourse at this point? And more broadly, are there other changes that our legal system needs to make to improve so that we don't see more Santoya Browns happening?
With respect to her legal options right now, there is a clemency petition that has been presented to the governor of Tennessee, and there has been quite a bit of public support that has been expressed through social media, hoping that that clemency petition will be favorably reviewed. I think that what her case represents to me, when I think about both her own personal circumstances and other Santoyas out there, is that we need a new punishment paradigm in this country, and we need a new paradigm for how we deal with offending by young men and women and boys and girls. I think that the notion that we have so little regard for the humanity, for the character, the potential for growth and development of these young people, that we are willing to lock them away in prison for decades, is not only inhumane, I think, within our own principles and values that I think we aspire to in our constitutional democracy, it is completely out of step with our international partners and peer countries around the world. There is no other country in the world that places children in prison for their lives, condemns them to die in prison. There are, frankly, few other countries in the world that try children as adults in the way that we do. 75,000 is a number that is down from 200,000 in the 1990s, but it is a shocking number, again, to our international colleagues, that we would place that many children into the adult criminal justice system. And I think what's important is that to the extent that we imagine our justice system is about both holding individuals accountable and promoting public safety, these are two legitimate goals of any justice system. The sentence imposed on Santoya, what she is confronting and facing right now, absent intervention, is one that serves neither of those purposes. She is not a risk. She is no longer a risk. The time to protect the public through her incarceration has long since passed. And she's been held accountable. She's surely been held accountable, having spent the number of years in prison that she has already spent there. And what we hope, and I think Cherie and I, working in this field, we are constantly confronted, unfortunately, with stories like Santoya's, and we are ever hopeful that this will be the one. This will be the one that will make us reevaluate, that will make us sit up and say, "No, this can't be." But again, that's my hope here, that the specter of a 16-year-old girl facing 51 years in prison for a crime that was conducted in the face of sex trafficking and a self-defense situation, and even without those particular mitigating circumstances, we cannot allow our young people to face these kinds of sentences in this country.
Marcia Levick is Chief Legal Officer at Juvenile Law Center. Thank you, Marcia.
Thank you.
And Jeree Thomas is Policy Director with the Campaign for Youth Justice. Thank you, Jeree.
Thank you.
Go to omahasteaks.com and enter code TAKEAWAY into the search bar to get 74% off Omaha Steaks Family Gift Package, now only $49.99. Order now and you'll get 4 hand-cut, age-to-tenderness top sirloin steaks, 2 savory premium pork chops, 4 chicken fried steaks, 4 Omaha Steaks burgers, 4 snappy kielbasa sausages, all beef meatballs, 4 perfectly browned potatoes au gratin, 4 made from scratch caramel apple tartlets, plus get 4 more burgers for free. Again, just go to omahasteaks.com, type takeaway into the search bar, and add the family gift package to your cart. Don't wait, order today.
Next Monday, 46 Cambodian refugees are scheduled to be deported from California to Cambodia. It will be the largest deportation flight of Cambodians in U.S. history.
Everyone on the flight came to the U.S. as a refugee, by and large, when they were infants and children. They had contact with the criminal system often 20 or 30 years ago, and now decades later being swept up for deportation.
Seer Oon is one of them.
Seer grew up in San Diego. Most of his family died in the genocide, but he was able to escape with his parents when he was an infant. When he was 19 years old, he served as a lookout while some other kids snuck into a house to steal some household items. He netted about $120 from the burglary. He spent a year in county jail as a result and then was ordered deported. Now, 20 years later, ICE detained him as a check-in. He's married, he's a parent, he's employed full-time. and he's scheduled to be deported next week and permanently separated from his family. He's currently applying for a pardon from the governor.
That's Anoop Prasad, a senior staff attorney for immigrant rights at the Asian Law Caucus, and he works with Cambodians like Seer who are holding out hope that California Governor Jerry Brown could intervene and halt the deportation order. According to data provided by ICE, as of September of this year, 110 Cambodian nationals have been deported. 74 were deported in 2016.
This community was not provided with mental health care, even though the PTSD and depression rates of the genocide survivors was off the charts. They were not given job training or language training. They have some of the highest unemployment, poverty, incarceration rates of any community. And so this generation that had come here as children, by the time they were hitting their teens, the U.S. was at the height of its mass incarceration crisis. And so they were having contact with police, entered into the criminal system often when they were still teenagers, 15, 16 years old. And then Congress passed a series of laws in the 1990s, which made deportation mandatory if you had a felony conviction or a long list of felony convictions. So they entered the criminal system, then were ordered deported. At the time, the U.S. did not have a deportation agreement with Cambodia. And so for a very long time, the U.S. could not deport people to Cambodia. Over the past several years, the U.S. has applied diplomatic pressure on Cambodia to get them to accept people for deportation. That diplomatic pressure has dramatically increased under the current administration with the use of visa sanctions and other threats to get Cambodia to accept more people for deportation. And so as a result, we've seen wave after wave of massive ICE raids on the Cambodian community over the last year.
Tell us a little bit about the types of crimes we're talking about here.
So it's a really wide range of crimes. Everything from drug offenses, assault, to burglary. I think what's really consistent in this group, though, is that these are people who had contacts with law enforcement, entered into the criminal system when they were teenagers in the 80s and 90s, and now are being deported for things in their 30s and 40s.
There are some folks who would say, well, if you break the law and you're not a U.S. citizen, then you should not be here.
Sure. So these people don't pose a danger to the community. Something that happened when someone was 17, 18, 19 years old doesn't accurately reflect who they are decades later. These people, by and large, have minor children of their own. They're working full-time to support their families. We've seen the impact that deportation has on these families. We see depression popping up in children after their parents get deported. We often see families struggling to make ends meet after losing a wage earner, having to rely on benefits, falling into poverty. When you look at the enormous hardship that this causes to American families, it really does not make very much sense.
I also spoke with Katya Sengal. She's the author of Exiled, From the Killing Fields of Cambodia to California and Back. And I wanted her to give us a sense of the history behind Cambodian migration to the United States.
Yes, so the Khmer Rouge was the 4 years, 1975-79, and as Anoop was saying, one of the worst killings of the 20th century. And there were about 158,000 Cambodians that came to the U.S. during that time, and almost every one of them had experienced near death due to starvation, and 90% had a family member or friend who had been murdered. A lot of them resettled in the inner cities. We got a lot in California, Lowell, Massachusetts, another Washington state. And U.S. refugee policy, and the U.N. criticizes the U.S. for this. You don't become an automatic citizen. A lot of countries, you come as a refugee, you end up being a citizen. In the U.S., that's not the process. You're a legal permanent resident. You have to wait another 5 years for citizenship. It costs quite a lot of money. And then there are also language barriers and such that people don't realize that importance of getting citizenship.
Right. A lot of immigrant and refugee children become citizens automatically when their parents become citizens. And that didn't happen in the Cambodian community for a few reasons. One is when Cambodian communities were resettled in the U.S., language classes weren't readily accessible. And so to become a citizen, you need to pass an English test, reading, writing, speaking, understanding, and also a U.S. history test. Their parents' generation largely was not able to pass that test. And then for this generation, they could have applied for citizenship when they turned 18. By that time, a lot of them had already entered the criminal system and were ineligible. And then I think for other Cambodian youth, this is the only country they have any memory of. Effectively, they consider themselves to be American. They never really thought about, I have to apply to become an American citizen. And it isn't something that really occurred to them until suddenly they're in immigration detention facing deportation.
Katya, have you followed up with any Cambodians who have been deported from the United States? And if so, what has the experience been for them?
Yeah, so there's 669 over there now. 16 of those are female, the rest are male. Incarcerated, 15, 29 deceased. And it's really hard because, as Anoop was saying, they consider themselves American. They were pretty much raised here. So this is what they know. So going over there is difficult. A lot speak the language, but they can't write it. One deportee says it's like spaghetti. It looks like spaghetti to him. So there's that. There's cultural differences. There's one of the men I wrote about in there, he was already deceased when I went there, but his friends had these pictures of him on their phones from his funeral. And I think he was just in his 30s, and he literally had drunk himself to death, a kind of form of suicide. And after I wrote the book, the mother of his daughter, who's a teenager in California, wrote me. And so just to realize there's this girl who has no chance now of having a father. And I think for some of that, that's that re-traumatization too of how it continues is once people are deported, then their children here now lose that parent. One of the people I wrote about who's facing deportation, David, his father was killed by the Khmer Rouge, and now he has a 7-year-old son. So when he is deported, his son will essentially lose him. And that deportation re-traumatizes his mother, a lot of times that oldest generation who was separated from their children under the Khmer Rouge, when that comes again, that threat of that separation, or when the separation comes again, it really re-traumatizes them all over again.
Anoop Prasad is a senior staff attorney for immigrant rights at the Asian Law Caucus, and Katya Sengal is author of Exiled from the Killing Fields of Cambodia to California and Back. Thank you to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's our show today. Remember, you can always find us on Facebook and join the conversation there. We're also on Twitter at The Takeaway. And tell us what you think about anything you heard on the show today. Just give us a call, 877-8-MY-TAKE. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
A lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.